and welcome to the menu, Monocle's food and drink show. I am Marcus Hippip. In the next 30 minutes, we meet Singaporean-born chef Elizabeth Haig, who has just released her debut cookbook, Makan, about the food of her family and her home country.
There's so much that you could say Singaporean food is, but for me, it's just the really delicious type, like food you just want to get stuck into and forget all your table manners and just dive headfirst into it.
Then American author and recipe developer Molly Buzz on how to become more efficient and less stressed in the kitchen.
That moment is the moment when you can then start to think about flavor and releasing yourself from the recipe itself.
We'll also hear a top dinner soundtrack recommendation and the week's food and drink headlines. That is all ahead on this edition of The Menu here on Monocle 24. We start today's program in London's world-famous Borough Market. That is where Elizabeth Haig runs her Singaporean food stall and kitchen counter, Mei Mei. Elizabeth has also just released her debut cookbook, Makan. It's a great guide to the rich food culture of Singapore, with its recipes that have been handed down from generation to generation in Elizabeth's family. What the book also does is to portray what Singaporean food really is, as it hasn't always been understood internationally. I met Elizabeth to talk about the food of Singapore and its rich influences. First, she explained what the name of her book means.
Makan means let's eat or dinner time. So at home, my mum would shout, let's makan or makan, and we would run down the stairs stampeding for dinner. It's the same in Singapore. You would sort of greet someone and say, should we go makan or let's makan? Because we skip all the pleasantries. It's all about eating when we're back home. And we think with our bellies. So you greet and you'll be like, let's go makan. So it's dinner time or let's eat together.
You have now released your cookbook, Makan. And I think it's interesting when I'm reading that, it becomes quite obvious that I thought I knew something about Singaporean food, but actually I was wrong. What is your impression? How widely is Singaporean food known?
I think that it's very widely known across the world, as in, like, people know of Singapore, but that, like, pinpoint what Singaporean food is, it is quite impossible. It's a bit of a challenge, like, what is the food from London? Because it's so multicultural, so diverse, it's hard to then go, this represents Singapore. I mean, there's a reason in Singapore we have multiple national dishes, because we can't decide. Singapore, like London, represents all different cultures and people from all over the world. And like I said in the book, it's basically we take in all these influences, all that knowledge, all that community, and we kind of combine it into one. So we have the Hainanese chicken rice, which is one of the national dishes, but we also have a Singapore laksa, but you also have chili crab. There's so much that you could say what Singaporean food is, but for me, it's just the really delicious type, like food you just want to get stuck into and forget all your table manners and just dive headfirst into it.
So what was your starting point when you started creating this book, writing it? What was your principle, what to include in terms of recipes and what to leave out?
When I started writing this book, I actually thought I had to do 300 recipes. And my publishers were like, no, Liz, you only need 100. And I was like, oh, well, that's great. We've got three books worth. So actually trying to whittle it down to the ones that went into the book. Basically, it was a sum of what we like the most for dinner time, what we like the most, and what I wanted to share with people to kind of grasp the idea of what Singaporean food is. So you've got noodle dishes, you've got your rice dishes. But importantly for this book, I didn't want to define those dishes by chapters in that way. How we have food, particularly with my family, it's occasions. So, okay, we're feeling a bit low today or we need a little pick-me-up. So we'd have a chapter where I call pick-me-up, where it's all about soups and things that make you feel nourished again or a bit more calm. Or we're having a celebration. So there's a chapter on dishes that we'd have like when we're trying to have a big occasion with friends and family, when we can have occasions again.
Many people probably noticed there was a train in the background. I'm doing this interview at Borough Market. I'm wondering, in terms of ingredients, for example, for these recipes you have in this book, how difficult is it to source those ingredients? For example, for your restaurant that is over here as well, do you find everything you need from here?
I do, mostly. We do have to import a few things like the pandan leaves, but a lot of the fresh ingredients, and that's one of the key things about Makan, a lot of our cooking, is you just get whatever's fresh and what's seasonal to you. And I think that's the wonderful thing about, particularly with East Southeast Asian cuisine, it's just whatever's fresh. because you just go to a normal market or wet market down the road and pick up the ingredients from there. And it's the same for here. Luckily, in Borough Market, you know, we're the sport for choice here. But a lot of the recipes that I put in this book is that stuff that you can get from a supermarket. But I always have a preference in going to a local market, little deli or little Southeast Asian supermarket to source my ingredients. A lot of it you can find. If you can't, it's usually online.
Tell me about cooking techniques. I know that you are a classically trained chef and you, for example, worked at Pigeon Restaurant in East London when it got its Michelin star. When you look at these recipes and the techniques required, how different are they? What is new and what is different for example, many of our listeners?
I think one of the key things about Singaporean cuisine, or definitely with the recipes in this book, is learning things about the techniques like spice pastes. I mean, again, that's very similar to like Indonesian, Malaysian, Indian cuisine, where you have a spice paste. So the rempah is what we call it, where it's a blend of your garlic, your ginger, your chili, some harder ingredients like lemongrass, galangal. You blend it all together. You can maybe add some spices, but you've got to toast those spices first. And then you cook that out very, very slowly in the pan to release all those aromats and the flavors from it. And for me, it's like a lot of the classic training I've done, it's like, if I might say making a jus, you'd basically cook things out very, very quickly. You get, you know, lots of heat and you add your aromats that way and then add in stocks and sauce. Basically, a lot of this, you just need to know the hearts of, like, cook out that rempah, don't rush it. But at the same time, there's also recipes in there from home. This is a home cookbook. This isn't the chef's cookbook. That's, I think, that's the main standout. This isn't complex. This is stuff that my mum's taught, her grandmother's taught her, and I'm just passing this on so that hopefully that my son will pick this up and he's able to cook from it. So it's not overly complex.
Tell me about the chapter that's called Nonya Secrets. That's something from your mother.
Yeah, so long story short, it's basically these secrets. So Nonya means auntie, and it's also a style of cuisine. So Nonya cuisine derives from the Peranakans. And this chapter is very much the recipes that's been passed down from her side of the family. And they're just probably ones that people haven't come across before. And we try to construct this chapter so that it's kind of like a, I'm not saying this is live or die what Nonya cuisine is. This is basically a snapshot of what we would have in Singapore. And they are secrets because my mother would literally go to the grave with those recipes. I had to pry them out of her.
Did you get all of them out?
No. No, I think there's some that she's hiding from me. Definitely. I think that's definitely, we're going to have to try and see how well this book does to get them for the book two and three.
Now, tell me about the dishes that are most meaningful for you. For example, what was your favourite as a child?
Oh, I have too many. Well, one of my favourite ones is the Singapore laksa because it's always the one that my mother would order whenever we came to Chinatown because it, for her that signified like feeling being at home. And whenever we go back to Singapore, we would always go and have a laksa. There's also one here in the chapter which is like a steamed crab dish. That is really special because that's my father's favourite. So each of this book, there's kind of like several favourites, so it's hard to pick. Again, it's like asking a Singaporean, like, what's your favourite dish? Because we can't, it's just depending on the mood.
And what's your family favourite at the moment? Before we started this interview, you mentioned that when you showed this book to your partner, he said that actually, like, you know, these are dishes you prepare at home all the time.
Yeah, so it depends on what we're feeling like. So that's why we had the chapters sort of in the way that it is, because I couldn't decide, oh, this is the meat dish that you'd have, or this is a veg dish. It's kind of like very, very typical with our family. We would have not just one of these dishes, you'd have several. You'd have like 2-3 dishes for a dinner. That's how normally Asian families would eat together. You'd have a meat dish, a rice dish, a veg dish, or a soup dish, and that's like your meal. So trying to pick one and kind of be like, it's quite obscure for us. I don't know, one of my favorites is basically this Blatchan skate wing, where we cook it on the barbecue or on the grill, wrapped in banana leaves with like a layer of sambal, which is like this very shrimpy, very, very heady in heat. But the flavour when you roast on a barbecue particularly, kind of just releases all that fragrance from the banana leaves into the fish. And the fish is like almost steamed because it's kind of protected by those leaves and the chilli. And it's just, there's this one spot in Singapore near to our house, it's maybe like a stone's throw away from our apartment, that we would go there, you're sitting around the table just like we are at the moment, and my dad would order a bucket of tiger beer, it will just literally, like, before it's even emptied, there'll be another one that the auntie brings over, and just, it will never stop. And then I would order the stingray. We use skate wing here, but there's a stingray over there. And my sisters will get a ginormous platter of satays. And just all those memories. A lot of the food in this book is about memories as well. I think that's what's really special about this. A very, very personal book. That's why we chose these dishes, because it's something that invokes a memory of home or here.
So the book's out now, and you've got another, 200 recipes waiting for your future releases. Any other future plans you'd like to mention at the moment?
We are reopened at Meme. Well, we've been operating as a takeaway business. Excitingly, we're doing an evening restaurant as well now here. It's nice and windy and cold here, but at least you've got hot and warm food, spicy food to warm you up with. And we are excitingly working on a noodle concept, which will be coming soon. Basically, watch this space. Yeah, and hopefully two more books gone away.
Elizabeth Haig there, and the name of her debut cookbook is Makan. You are listening to The Menu. Let's next continue with this week's food and drink headlines. Here is Monocle's Maile Evans.
Thanks, Marcus. First, it's a short hop to Harrods in London, where over the last few years, the famous department store has been revamping the interiors of its notoriously well-stocked food halls. With the roastery and bake hall, the fresh market hall and the dining hall all updated, the recent reveal of the newly designed chocolate hall marks the end of the refurbishment project. Having sold chocolates for over 150 years, the store chose David Collins Studio to revive the room whilst retaining that classic Harrods feel. Next to Finland, where airline food is continuing to take off. Like many airlines, Finnair pivoted to providing its signature meals in supermarkets during lockdown. However, in reaction to high demand, they are now offering a delivery service from their Vantaa-based kitchen. Even with flight schedules predicted to pick up in the upcoming months, it seems that Taste of Finnair will become a permanent part of the airline's operations, meaning you won't need to board a flight for your fix of reindeer meatballs or smoked rainbow trout. Next to Ukraine, where the Chernobyl Spirits Company has found themselves in a spot of bother with authorities. That's because a shipment of the company's atomic vodka, which is made using apples grown near the Chernobyl exclusion zone, was intercepted on its way to the UK for having supposedly incorrect labelling. The company, whose vodka uses slightly radioactive ingredients that scientists say are completely safe, denies any wrongdoing. Finally, to New York, where the National Trust for Historic Preservation has announced 25 culturally significant US restaurants that will receive $40,000 through the Backing Historic Small Restaurants grant program. From Alfreda's Soul Food in Houston to Kegel's Inn in Milwaukee, the grant will not only provide vital funding, but also numerous training programs that will guide the owners through marketing strategies, digitization, and social media. That's all for this week. Back to you, Marcus.
Thanks, Maile. You are with The Menu on Monocle 24. Then let's continue with another cookbook that promises to make you a smarter, faster and more creative cook. American food editor and recipe developer Molly Bass's new release Cook This Book is out now, and it does indeed offer great advice on how to become less stressed and more efficient in the kitchen. Let's hear more from Molly herself.
I think that the whole sort of concept behind this book and the driving principle is that in order to become a great cook and in order to sort of like free yourself from the shackles of a recipe and to become flexible and improvisational in the kitchen, you really need to learn a good foundation and technique. So that technique is sort of like the foundation of all good cooking. And I think that where home cooks really struggle is that they follow recipes. They might go on Google and they'll look up a specific recipe, or they'll see something on Instagram and it looks really great. They'll follow that recipe, but they're not taking like a holistic approach to really learning the foundations of cooking. And they're just cooking different recipes here or there without sort of like the real purpose of gaining a deep knowledge. And so the concept of this book is that every chapter is dedicated to a specific category in cooking. So like chicken and eggs and vegetables and beef and pork. And as you make your way through the recipes, each chapter is a sort of comprehensive look at all of the ways that I consider to be fundamental techniques to learning how to cook that particular protein or item. And so it's more about a really thorough breadth of knowledge that as you cook your way through the book, you're gaining all of these insights, you're experiencing all of these different techniques. And if you were to cook your way through the whole thing, theoretically, you'd come out the other end super well equipped, exposed to all different kinds of techniques. And there, that moment is the moment when you can then start to think about flavor and releasing yourself from the recipe itself.
Let's talk about your relationship with recipes. I think it's interesting that you mention in the book that you didn't really appreciate or respect recipes, not people who used recipes in the beginning years ago.
Yeah, well, I got my career start working in professional kitchens, working in restaurants. And there was this sort of like general consensus or mentality that in order to be a great cook, you need to just be completely on your own, self-sufficient, ready to tackle anything at any moment, and completely free of recipes, that like you should have enough innate knowledge to not ever have to look at a recipe. That was at least sort of like the story that I told myself when I was first starting out in food and in my career. And it wasn't until I got to food media and to working at a food magazine when I started recipe testing at Epicurious that I started to really gain a respect for recipes, because I had never really considered the fact that a recipe actually takes a great deal of work. A great recipe takes a great deal of work, and it's the culmination of many different tests and trials. And basically following a recipe kind of ensures you that a good recipe anyway, ensures you success in the kitchen, because somebody's done all of the legwork for you and they've tested it and they've tried it a few different ways. And then they've had someone else test it, and that's the cross tester's job. And so I began to realize that recipes are actually super reliable, and there's a lot of learning to be had in recipes, even for someone who is a highly proficient, skilled professional cook, because it's also a little entryway into somebody else's culinary brain. And that is why I love recipes so much today. I don't necessarily need recipes in terms of teaching me any particular technique, but what I need them for is to open my mind up to other ways of thinking about the foods, the ingredients, the dishes that I am used to cooking. And so that's where I think they become really valuable. And I love recipes now.
Super. And I have to ask, this book is full of great tips and pieces of advice. What was the most difficult thing for you to learn when you were on your way to become a great cook?
There wasn't any particular like isolated technique that was difficult for me to learn. I would say that one thing that I never really got proficient in is like whole animal butchery. I got experience in it working in restaurants, and I can break down poultry very easily, but I never really had the experience of working at a butcher shop or in a restaurant that did whole animal butchery where I was responsible for that. And I feel like that's obviously something that's a bit beyond the scope of what a home cook would normally tackle. I mean, it's not every day that a home cook brings a whole steer into their home to break down, but that's something that, at least for me in my journey of learning, I would like to master.
You also mentioned that you love salt. And if we go through some kind of a checklist of, you know, when home cooks come up with something that's a bit bland and tasteless, how often is it about lack of salt, and how often is it about something else?
I think that the number one culprit of lackluster food in home kitchens is most likely salt. Obviously, that's not always the case, but there's a part of my book that, as you mentioned, has these checklists where you can refer to them when you feel that when you've made something and it's just not exactly right and it's tasting kind of meh and you're like, I don't really know why this isn't right, but all I know is like, this is not the best, most delicious thing I've ever had and I want to get it there. And the first step in that checklist for me always is take a little bit of whatever you've made. So take like a spoonful of the soup or a little bit of that sauce and remove it from the rest of the dish and season it. And if that little bit of extra salt on that one spoonful ignites your palate and makes everything start to like really taste again, then you know that you've under-seasoned your food. And so I think that one thing that home cooks struggle with is like the idea of continually seasoning as they go, that it's like, you don't have to, it's not just a matter of seasoning with some salt at the beginning and like hoping it turns out well and like, hopefully I did enough salt. You should be tasting your food constantly as you go and readjusting the seasoning as you go. And I probably season my food 3 or 4 times throughout as it's cooking, if it's something like a soup or a stew or something that cooks for a long time, because there are so many different variables that are always in flux. And so I do think that under seasoning is the number one culprit of sort of like meh food, and that people need to get more comfortable with their own hand in seasoning.
Well, I have to say that you do use salt, and I'm one of those people who has been quite careful with salt, and I spotted at least one recipe where you advise people at home to use 1 whole tablespoonful of salt, and then you also mentioned that that is right. That's not a mistake. What do you reason over there?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure what recipe you're referring to, but the one that pops into my head is, I think, a recipe for smushed and crispy potatoes with salt and vinegar sour cream. And so there, you get little baby Yukon Gold potatoes and you boil them first in salted water and then drain them, smash them, and roast them in the oven. And the recipe calls for 1 whole cup, not tablespoon, of kosher salt to be added to the water that the potatoes boil in. And I reassure you in the recipe that that's not a typo, because I know that sounds like a preposterous amount of salt, but I've tested the recipe many times with that amount of salt and it doesn't turn out salty. If you really think about it, if you have, let's say, 3 or 4 quarts of water in a pot and you've added 1 or 2 pounds of potatoes to that, but you're ultimately going to drain that water and it's all going to go down the drain. So most of that salt is actually getting thrown out, and it's actually just a little bit of it that actually makes its way into the potatoes to season them.
I think another very useful and interesting chapter you had in this book was about what to do if you're missing an ingredient at home when you're cooking. And you also had a checklist there.
Yeah, sort of like following the through line of what we just talked about, how like a foundation of good technique is crucial before you can really start to improvise in the kitchen. Beyond that, it's an understanding of flavor that you need in order to be able to be flexible and to learn how to substitute and swap ingredients. So there's an equation that is the heart of this book, and that is technique times flavor equals cooking. So once you've got the technique down, as in you've cooked through all of the recipes in the book and you've tried your hand at all the different ways to cook a chicken and all the different ways to cook an egg, then you start to think about the flavor element of cooking. And there's a whole chapter here that's dedicated to explaining what the different flavor profiles are that our palates can perceive, and then thinking about the way those different flavor profiles interact with one another to make really dynamic tasting food. And so the more that you introduce ingredients that are complements and contrasts to one another within those flavor profiles, the sweet, the salty, the bitter, the spicy, the fatty, et cetera, the more your food starts to really like fire up your palate. And so within the book, there are lists of inspiration that list out many of the ingredients that will be called for within the book and categorize them by their most prominent flavor profile, so that if you get to a recipe in the book and you realize, shoot, you're out of red pepper flake, but you understand that that red pepper flake is serving a purpose in the recipe. It's adding spice and heat to something that would otherwise be pretty mellow and one note and fatty. And so you don't want to just leave the red pepper flake out altogether. You can reference these lists and you'll see lists of all different ingredients that are also spicy that are not just red pepper flakes. There's fresh peppers and there's different kinds of chili oils and there's horseradish and there's mustard and there's black pepper, because spice comes in a lot of ways, shapes, and forms.
And just finally, before I let you go, I know it may be difficult to pick your favorite recipes from all these great ones you have included in this book, but if you were to name 2 or 3, what would they be?
It's so hard. Every podcast I've been on, every interview I've had, this question comes up, and I think I say something different every time. So the answer I will tell you today is just how I'm feeling. I've been thinking a lot about this chorizo and chickpea carbonara dish that I developed for the book. And it is basically, it kind of takes like the classic technique of carbonara, of emulsifying raw eggs into your pasta sauce in order to thicken it and make it nice and creamy, but swaps out the bacon for dry cured chorizo, which is really like smoky and spicy. And then it also adds in chickpeas into the carbonara sauce. So the chickpeas kind of like sizzle and fry in the chorizo fat, but then you add in the eggs and parm and black pepper and all of those other common ingredients that you find in carbonara. And so it ends up feeling like carbonara, but tasting a little fun and funky and a little different. It's a little bit smokier, and I think it's pretty great.
Molly Bassett there. She's the author of Cook This Book, Techniques That Teach and Recipes to Repeat. And that's all for this edition of The Menu. For previous episodes of this program, go to Monaco's website, SoundCloud or Apple Podcasts. And remember to subscribe to the show so that it automatically arrives onto your device every week. Also, do check out our menu spin-off show, Food Neighbourhoods, for great recipes. This show was researched by Charlie Filmacourt and edited and mixed by David Stevens. I am Marcus Hippi. Once again, we finish this program with a dinner soundtrack recommendation. This time from France, here is La Femme with Nouvelle Orléans. Thanks for listening.
J'ai